Colonel Jones, Reel 3. So, General Slim, talking to the troops, he must have had a very good idea of exactly what was going on and exactly...
Yes, I think, again, we were back to the question of he knew what to do, he knew how to do it, he didn't have the stuff to use.
What was he short of?
Well, aircraft was the main thing, particularly for supply aircraft. That's what turned the battle from losing to winning, was allowing ourselves to be surrounded, which we were in the later on. After that withdrawal, General Slim was sent for by the Army Commander, General Irwin, and I went with him. And Irwin sacked him on the spot. And he was a bit depressed on the way back to home. I mean, a youngster like me, I didn't know what to say to a general who'd been sacked. I'd never been with a general who'd been sacked before. But as we got back, the news came through that General Irwin had been sacked and Bill Stone was going to take his place as Army Commander. So that was quite something that didn't happen to many people to witness that.
What was his reaction to that?
Oh, he was delighted. But he didn't crow about it. I mean, he was just sort of felt, well, now he could get on with the job and do it the way he wanted to do it.
When you were in the Arakan, what were your living conditions like?
Well, we thought they were quite good, but I imagine most people would say it was pretty frightful. But we had we were dug in. We would have a sort of a hole in the ground, fairly, you know, perhaps 8 feet by 10 feet, something like that. And you'd have a small tent, 40-pounder tent there, and that was your domain. And you'd have I had a Gurkha orderly who looked after you. And operations tent was probably about 25, 30 yards away. That was all if I had to go to work. And the mess, we had, what struck me about the mess, we had a wooden floor. I never discovered where we managed to steal that. But we had a couple of settees and armchairs in the middle of the jungle, which was quite absurd, really, but quite luxurious as far as we were concerned. We were well fed, no doubt about that. There was never any shortage of food, as far as I could see.
What were the men's living conditions like?
The
other ranks?
Well, I didn't have much to do with them then. I mean, they were possibly a mile away, the nearest infantry. And I felt that that was their job, their own officers to look after them. And I didn't take much interest in them. I had to later on, obviously. But at that time, my job was to make sure that orders were correct when they went out, double-check them, and make sure they got there, and do a bit of planning with the BGS, the Brigadier General Staff, to make sure the Corps Commander's orders were implemented.
So you were working in the operations tent?
Yes, yes. Every morning, we had a morning, with Bill Slim, we had a morning prayers. They weren't prayers at all, they were information, and everybody who could would gather round, and we'd have the boards, the blackboard up. The intelligence officer would start giving the chap called Bill Gunn, who was an employee of one of the Burma teak companies, I think, was Bill, great bridge player. And he would give the intelligence side of it, then I would give the operational side. Probably give almost all of it. Occasionally I had to conceal a unit's name or an operation which was a bit secret, perhaps. I wouldn't tell them, but I tried to keep them interested, and that used to last about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes every morning. Open air, of course.
So what sort of operations were going on that were secret?
Well, there was a force called V Force, Force 15136. That's right. We were operating behind Japanese line. Excuse me.
Do you want to stop for a moment?
Yeah, switch off for a moment, will you?
So you're telling me about one of the more secret operations.
Yes, V Force were working behind Japanese lines, and occasionally we would send a column around to on the flank to do something, probing probably, and we wouldn't want everyone to know about it. But we were doing raids on the coast with the West Africans. They were operating there, which we didn't want the people to know until we'd had a successful operation. If there was any doubt about things working properly or not, we probably would keep it secret for a day or two until we were sure that we could announce a victory. I think that was probably morale more than anything else intended for.
So you actually had a fairly accurate picture, didn't you?
Oh, yes. We had three or four divisions down there, two Indian, one West African, and one British at one time. The famous, I think the Arakan, probably most people who know it would remember the Battle of the Admin Box, where it was the first time that we beat the Japanese, really.
Can you tell me about that?
We were going to do an attack on the Mayo Peninsula. The Japanese knew we were going to do it, and we didn't know that they were going to attack before us. And we were all genned up for it, and we'd packed this admin box with ammunition, food, all the medical supplies, and established a hospital there. And about 2 days before we were going to advance, they did a night attack and got round behind us. The usual panic for an hour or two, and then we had the first airdrop, and I remember being surprised at the fact that we were having newspapers, mail, luxury goods, nothing military essential, because we already had it. I thought how stupid, and then I realized how very clever it was that we, even the stuff that landed with the Japs, they must have thought, well, these people are mad that they can afford to use aircraft for this sort of stuff. You know, newspapers in particular were a great demand. Troops loved to hear, and of course, mail even more so. And even stuff for the, what do you call it, what the Americans call a PX.
Nappy.
For the nappy, that's right. We had whiskey and biro pens and things like that. I think biros in those days were quite something, you know. They only just come around, and they were worth about £5 or £6, I think. So that had an effect, I think, the first airdrop. And after that, it got a bit gruesome with the Japs. Broke into a hospital and killed the doctors, the nurses, and the patients. I think that probably had a very good effect on us. Perhaps we weren't too serious about killing Japs before that, but I think then we decided, right, they're not fit to live now, and we need to be a bit more serious about our reaction.
Did you see that hospital? Were you there?
No, I saw it the day before.
What sort of a hospital was it? Can you describe what it was?
Well, like it was a very large, two very large khaki tents. I mean, I only saw it for probably, say, 20-yard distance. I had no reason to go there. Just sort of, hello, there's the hospital. But it certainly angered us, I think, the fact that the doctors and the nurses had been killed, I think, was the last...
Sorry. But they're female nurses?
Yes, they were, yes.
Oh, right.
Yes.
What, Queen Alexandra's?
QAs, yes, yes.
So a change of mood there.
I think that was the, yes. And the fact that we were getting supplied by air, we needn't rush back. We stayed where we were. There was a division coming down from the north. And we were to be the anvil and they would be the hammer. And the Japs would find themselves surrounded instead of surrounding us. And it worked that way. And that was Bill Slim's plan. He'd gone by this time, of course. He'd gone to army. He was the army commander now. And we had General Christensen, who died quite recently, aged 100 odd. He was our corps commander then.
Right. So you were working with him then?
So I was his G1 then, a G2.
How did he vary from...
Not a lot. He was more reserved. He wasn't quite as outward going as Bill Slim. A bit more reserved. But he was undoubtedly inspired confidence, as did Bill Slim.
How much contact did you have with the the frontline troops? Or were you staying very
not, not a lot. You felt that you were... I used to arrange for air raids for them, air support, bombing and strafing, but it was all done at a distance. Perhaps you would meet them at halfway house to save travelling too far. Only a couple of miles, but still it were jungle tracks anyway. Generally speaking, I had very little to do with the infantry soldier then. Sometimes talk to the gunners about gunning ammunition and things like that, support, but generally very little to do with them. At that time, we had a new brigadier from East Africa who was with us for only a short time. He didn't do very well and was changed, shall we say. And about 3 or 4 weeks later, after the battle was over and we'd tidied up in there, I got an offer of a job in Nairobi as East Africa commander, through him that was, and I was very tempted to take it, and then I thought, well, I don't know, I've been in the Arakan now all this time and haven't really seen any fighting, and I can't go back home and say I was a staff officer all the war. So I turned it down, and I saw Bill Slim and asked him could he cancel it, and he said yes, but perhaps it's time you did a bit of honest soldiering. And I said, well, I think you're probably right. So I was then posted to the 2nd Dorset 2nd Division. And I'd been in the 2nd Division in France in 1940. It's rather strange that and they were in the Kohima Imphal area. So I went up there in June 44. June 44.
So what was their situation when you got there?
Things were a bit mixed. We were still at the tail end of the Japanese invasion of the March on India, that they'd called it. They'd surrounded Imphal, cut off the Manipur plain from Dimapur, the railhead, and Japanese were everywhere in small parties. They'd really been beaten, but they were still fighting pretty hard. So we took over. When I arrived, we were on a hill south of Imphal called Gibraltar. Gibraltar, that's right. Malta was next door to us. We took over from the Gurkhas, and I was given a stone dugout, which was just about 6 feet long. I could just about sleep in it. Occupied by a very large rat. In front of me, I had a field of fire. I could see blasted trees, and that was all. And somewhere in the mist beyond were the Japanese, apparently. But they were pretty inactive for the 2 days we were there. And then they withdrew, I think, and we followed up. And we got as far as Tamu, which was on the road to the Chinwin River. I went into Tamu. I went down to see one of the leading companies. They were supposed to be no further than a dried-up Chung riverlet in front of us. And I went down there, and I couldn't see anybody. I could see the pretty rickety bridge.
When you say you went down, you were in a vehicle? Or?
Yes, I took my... I took my Jeep down.
On your own?
No, I had a driver, a signalman, and my gunman, Batman, the four of us. And I quite wrongly said, all right, we'll go on to Tamu and have a look. I got to Tamu, and it was full of bodies and flies, horrible sight. A lot of dead Japanese lying around there. I picked up a couple of identity discs and paybooks, really, from the Japs. Not that we really needed them, because I think we had a pretty good idea what units we were against for that time. I came back and reported to the CO that I'd been into Tamu. He gave me a rocket for going beyond the line of that we were supposed to. But he reported to brigade. And that night, the Indian news which we were getting, we were using civilian radios for news bulletins and things. Mr. Churchill announced in the House of Commons that the British Army had recaptured Tamu. That was me. But officially, the next day, the Worcesters went in and occupied it. But I thought that that's the way they run news bulletins, and it'd be very suspect in the future. Captured, and it was really just a recce. Yeah.
So who had killed the Japs at Tamu then?
Oh, disease. They were all, oh, yes. Yes.
Right, so they'd been wiped out.
Oh, yes, yes. They starved probably half of them, and then they'd caught beriberi or malaria or something. Oh, yes, they were all... maybe the odd one or two might have been still alive. But I told the two, the gunman and the signaller, to keep their arms ready and shoot anything that moved while I was mucking about in the bodies in case somebody woke up. But, oh, yes, it was only unnatural causes, I suppose, but certainly disease had killed them.
So, useful intelligence, though.
Yes.
It was obviously relayed back to London.
Well, it must have gone back pretty quickly. We were on the air to brigade, of course, and they were to division army, and it would be back in probably half an hour, perhaps. And we weren't getting many victories, so I suppose... And it was a place on the map. And as Churchill said, it's a place I can a name I can pronounce. I think he used as Tamu. Then we pulled back from there for 2 months' rest.
And when did you go for your rest?
In fact, I was given leave, then I went to Kashmir.
Oh, right.
It's Srinagar, yes.
So what was Kashmir like then?
Oh, lovely.
In those days? Can you describe it?
It was like Shangri-La. Yes, oh yes. The famous Dal Lake with its... what were the name of the boats they used to use? Oh, I can't think of. I've got a model one upstairs somewhere.
Not a Dow.
No. Shikara or something like that it was. Uh-huh. Hmm.
Was it full of military?
Yes, a lot of people on leave. It's a very popular place for leave, yes. Yeah.
How did you get there? You went by train?
Indian train, yes. And the last... Yes, the last 30 miles, 40 miles would have been a taxi. There's no railway up there, because you're starting almost the famous passes of India. What's the most famous of them?
The Khyber.
Yes, almost. I believe It's the next pass to the Khyber, I think. That certainly was at the foot of the Khyber, Rawalpindi and places like that on the way up. As far as I went by train, I think it was from Rawalpindi, I went by taxi, Kashmir.
Motorised taxi.
Yes, oh yes.
Yeah. Where did you stay in Kashmir?
What was it called? Nidus, I think. It was the sort of the only decent or the best hotel there. Well, I mean, in those days, I was earning money and not being able to spend it. And G2s were very well paid, more than they were worth, I always thought. But I took it.
So what was life like there for your holiday?
Oh, lovely, yes.
What did you do each day?
Well, that's a very good question. I think I hung around the boat, swimming a bit, I suppose, wondering what to have for dinner.
Lots of British people
there? Yes, and a lot of civilians there too. Civilian wives were there from Lahore and places like that. I was lucky in as much as a chap from the same battalion had gone in front of me. He'd been there a week before I got there, and I picked up with him. So I had companionship all the time I was there. And we got onto a couple of other soldiers there. Yes, Kashmir was lovely. I went up to the famous Gulmarg, which is in probably 10,000 feet, I think, or 12,000, you begin to feel the effect of altitude. Then that was by mule, I think we went up there. I have a mule track.
So at the end of your leave?
Yes, leave back to Kohima, and then November we started to move down and back to Tambu, and then I think we crossed the famous pontoon bridge, Bailey pontoon bridge, the longest thing that they'd made up to that time, over the Chinwin, and I think we crossed on Christmas Eve. And I remember Christmas morning de Havilland moth flying in front of us. We could only just see it through the gap in the trees. We were on the road. And I think it was something Happy Christmas was on it. I don't know whether the word Pongo was on it as well, which was a famous name the Air Force used to use for the army. A brown-coated individual living in caves, I think, was the description of a Pongo. And I remember seeing that plane, Happy Christmas, on Christmas Day 44.
So, when you say we went there, what was the establishment?
Oh, we were down our division, 2nd Division.
Right, and who was the commanding?
General, we called him Cammy Nix, General Nicholson. Yes. I saw him again at the Irrawaddy crossing, but he was the commanding general then. We then advanced to Yeo. This is where I came under fire really for the first time.
What was Yeo like? Can you describe the terrain and the situation of the enemy?
Well, we were out. We'd come through the jungle by this time, about 10 miles at least, or. Yes, 10, 15 miles away from jungle. It was fairly open country, rather a lot like England, I would say, English countryside, the odd clumps of trees here and there. I don't remember much about the town because we arrived in the dark and we sheltered because we had the odd shell coming over in pagoda. Then the next morning, the CO planned an attack. Two companies going straight in, and one company going round to the left, over the right, on a right-hand hook to come in behind the Japs at the bridge at the end of the village, which we knew had been blown anyway. But we wanted to get the approach to the bridge, so we could start organizing a bridge for the replacement. And the company went off the air at about 11 o'clock, and the CEO was afraid that something might have happened. They wouldn't get round there, so he sent me off to find them and make sure they got to the bridge. And I went off with my gunman, Batman, called Sibley, and we were out in the open, paddy fields, and suddenly two flips of bullets went past my left ear, over Sibley's right nose, or over his nose rather, and we dashed like blazes for cover. And the cover was only about a foot high paddy bund anyway, but I flung myself down there with Sibley alongside me. And I thought, well, we better see if we can find this chap. So I crawled forward on my elbows, went to get my binoculars, and they'd gone. So I happened to casually say, oh, Sibley, I must have dropped my binoculars back there. And he said, they can bloody well stay there, too. So after a minute or two, we moved, and whether it was the gun had jammed, it was the last two rounds, or he'd moved, we never know. But I didn't go back for my binoculars. I went on and found the company and drew them around. That was about 11:30, I should think, those two shots came at me. I then started to work out. I knew in the morning, fairly soon, I'd have to get somebody across the river at the bridge. The CO was interested in the left-hand side. So I went down to the river bank, and it was fairly heavily treed, this part. The town itself wasn't, but there were. So I climbed up a tree, went up about 15 feet, I suppose, and I could see, flat on the other side. The river was about a quarter mile wide, not very deep. I could see countryside, and I could see a small plantation. And with that, a shell arrived just above my head. And it was obviously from a Japanese 50-millimeter gun, what they call their battalion gun. So before I could collect my wits about me, a second one arrived, slightly to the left, by which time I was on my way down. And the third one arrived, probably near enough where I was sitting, but this time I was down on the ground. So I was really sniped by an artillery cannon. That was three rounds. I got away with that. And then I was still in the same area, walking the river bank at about 4 o'clock, I think it was. And a shot came out of the undergrowth, so I went behind this tree and Sibley went across the other side of the track. And I thought for a moment, and I guessed it would be about 20, 25 yards away. So I shouted to Sibley, grenades. And I pulled a grenade out and threw it, or bowled it rather. Unfortunately, I'd gone the wrong side because I, being right-handed, I had to sort of do everything from the left-hand side on the track. And Sibley was all right. He was right-handed anyway. So three grenades went off, and I'd only bowled one, and Sibley only bowled one, so there must have been a Japanese grenade somewhere. Then I came carefully around the tree, and I picked my hand up, and I thought, hello, I've lost my finger. Because that finger there was all blood, and I hadn't felt anything at all. So I stuck it in my mouth. I said, oh, that's not so bad. It was it'll flip in the top. So we dispatched the Jap by this time, and then I couldn't stop the bleeding. It was very deep, but very fine. So I walked back to the RAP, which was about 30 miles back in the village, and then I saw some real casualties. We'd been shelling all day, and they were coming in casualties, and the poor MO was really hard put to. Because I looked at one chap lying on the table, and I said, that's funny, he's gone a funny colour. He's gone grey. And he said, so would you if you bloody died. The chap died, his leg had been severed right at the top.